284 AL in Halle Eva, and it's time right now for In the Garden on the Farm. It's time, everybody.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KKCR, its board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha, and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm. It's your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Paul and Robin, and on today's show, we'll inspire ourselves to utilize the bounty of coconuts on our islands, explore Araceae, the taro family, and get our wiggle on with worm castings. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you, in partnership with our generous underwriters.
Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe in Hanalei is proud to support KKCR and its Ohana, offering organic groceries and produce, a cafe featuring fresh salad bar, hot meals and soups, fresh-made smoothies, and baked goods. Located in the heart of Hanalei, Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, 826-0089.
Kauai Marine and Mower, located in Old Kapa'a Town, is proud to underwrite this KKCR program. Kauai Marine and Mower features Honda garden and lawn equipment and also Echo power equipment. 823-0556.
Anahola Stringed Instruments is proud to support KKCR. Mickey Sussman has been building island koa guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972. Time-honored design and special orders. Prompt and complete restoration, repair, and reforestation. AnaholaStringedInstruments.com or 822-1645.
Aya's Garden, all-natural garden and greenhouse supply. In Kapa'a, down Kukui Street from the Dragon Building. Fertilizers, amendments, soil, seeds, garden and farm organic growing supplies. Open Monday through Saturday. More information at 822-7333 or visit Aya's Garden on Facebook.
Oh, yes, we're back in the garden. It's true. Robin.
Aloha.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be back home on Kauai, and I just couldn't be happier about some rain this morning. It's just so wonderful.
Indeed it is. Good for all of our, all that ails us in terms of our spirits and also for the beautiful plants that might be a little bit out of range of the hose. I've been carrying water to some plantings that I planted a bit further out than the irrigation system was designed to meet. So I was so grateful this morning to see, wow, they're getting a nice soak in today.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to jump into our celestial session. It just so turns out that it's not just the wind, the rain, but there's lots of other forces of nature that are at play that influence the plants. And we are guided by the ancestral knowledge and the great work of many people who've come before us. We truly stand on the shoulders of giants. And so we are here to carry on those traditions and to share them. And we will share the wisdom of the host culture here in Hawaii, the traditional Hawaiian knowledge of the mahina or moon. And we are going to drop into the knowledge shared by the 2014 Ke Alaoka Mahina calendar. It's a publication of Hui Maoli Ola and Kamehameha schools. And today's Hawaiian moon phase is Huna. And this is right at the beginning. It is the very first moon phase in the Poipoi, rounding or full on Ahulu. It's the second week in the Hawaiian moon month. And it's just when the moon has lost its horns and has become more rounded at the edges. And Huna will rise on Kauai faithfully today at 2:32 p.m. She will reach her transit, her highest point in the sky, at 8:04 p.m. this evening, and she'll set at 1:46 a.m. tomorrow morning, early. 66% of the moon's beautiful face will be illuminated as she rises above the horizon. And we just had the first quarter moon yesterday at 1:11 a.m. Huna is the first of 10 moons in Poipoi. And it's said that the name Huna reflects the fact that the moon hides its horns for the first time on this moon. Huna means hidden, secret, or hidden. And so it's said that secrets will remain hidden today. And it's also a minute particle, a grain, a crumb, a speck, a tiny bit. And planting recommendations for today: ipu and root plants, of which we are going to celebrate greatly today. So this would be a good day for getting out there, as long as the soil is not too wet, and working with those plants. Robin.
Excellent. Well, in the biodynamic look at things, we are in the ascending moon period, so the sap has risen to the upper parts of the plant during this time. And today and tomorrow, the moon is in Sagittarius, a fire sign, making it a time to work with our fruiting plants. This could be a good time to harvest fruits. In fact, when the moon is in either air signs or fire signs, in general, there's less sap flowing. So if you've ever cut a breadfruit, say, off of the tree on a very watery day, you will notice that it gives and gives and gives of the white sap. Could make big puddles in the bottom of your harvesting basket even.
And maybe on your clothing if you're not careful.
If it's your first time. So, great time to pick breadfruits, and you can see for yourself if there's more or less sap flowing today. Friday and Saturday, the moon will enter Capricorn, an earth sign, making it time to work with our root plants. And with root plants like kalo, for instance, sometimes some leaf pruning is necessary as the lower ones tend to die off. I think that's what I'll probably be doing this weekend. Sunday, the moon is in an unproductive state, so it's a good time to sharpen our tools, build compost, pull vines off the fences.
Or maybe just rest.
Or perhaps just rest. Having just come back from vacation, I feel quite rested and pretty ready to charge in the garden. But who knows what I'll feel like on Sunday. Monday, the moon will enter Aquarius, an air sign, making it time to work with our flowering plants. And I really like to do cuttings on these days. It's through experimentation I've learned they do very well, and I get the highest percentage to take on days just like that. And Tuesday next, the moon will be in Pisces, a water sign, making it time to work with our leaf plants. So also potentially a good time to do some pruning, weather permitting.
Very nice. Thank you so much for that oracle read on our coming week. And we are wanting to share with you all kinds of things today. We'll start off with a small notable news topic. Sometimes it's nice. We get the vision for something and then we're scrambling to get the funds together. Well, we have a notable news item sort of the other way around, if you will, expanding on the Go Farm program on Kauai, which had a very successful season this spring and into the summer. The program received $25,000 in support just a few days ago for the Kauai Community College program from the Doc Byers Fund at Hawaii Community Foundation. And they've been training farmers. It's a reformulation of various training resource methodologies that have been developed at the University of Hawaii system. It's having a lot of success on the other islands as well. And we want to let folks know that the program is not currently scheduled for the next session, but certainly with a $25,000 injection of funds, I'm sure that they're going to get it together. Our friend Catherine O'Brien, who led the program this past time, has returned to the mainland, and it seems as if the college is going to be seeking somebody to fill that position. The position has not yet been posted, but let's dig into our bag of tricks and find a instructor who could lead that program in a great way. Certainly we have a lot of knowledgeable people here. It's going to have to be combined with some sort of a master's degree probably as well, but great program at KCC. Looking forward to that continuing, and good to know that it's got an injection of funds to make it happen.
Yeah, that's excellent news.
Yeah, super cool. So In the Garden on the Farm is your radio program today with Paul and Robin's here as well. And we are going to be focusing in on a very special plant family here. I think you'll be surprised to learn about some of the family members. We always get surprised when we do our research. Oh, my gosh, I didn't know that that was related to that. So we will be talking about the Araceae family later on. But right now we are going to take a look at a plant that may be in your kitchen garden. It was in my kitchen garden in the last garden that I had, and I'm looking forward to having it in the kitchen garden again. It is one of those plants, like other ones in the kitchen garden, where it's great if you can just grab it when you're preparing a meal, and Robin's going to tell us more about that treat.
Yes, well, having just freshly returned from a short trip to French Polynesia, which was absolutely spectacular, I got really inspired by the coconut there. We know it, we've heard it, we've said it, it's the most important plant, but, you know, somehow it felt really like too much work to really go up there and get a coconut and open it. For me, I speak for myself, but seeing what people do with the coconut there and how valuable it is and what an incredible resource it is, I'm more inspired to harvest the coconuts that are nearby me and use them more than I have been. You'll remember from our month discussion on the palm family when we focused in greatly on the coconut palm. Coconuts are rich in calories, vitamins, and minerals, and basically are considered a complete food. The edible meat and water from an average-sized nut provide almost all the daily required essential minerals, vitamins, and energy for a medium-sized person. So really, this plant is a phenomenal source of food. The electrolytes in coconut water are great to beat tropical thirst. They also carry plenty of minerals in them that are really good for our bodies. The young meat out of a very young coconut is absolutely delectable if you're into spoon meat, really one of the greatest treats around. Mature meat can be sliced thinly and marinated, dehydrated, and used as a really excellent snack that's high in all those good things that our bodies need. And mature meat can also be grated to produce coconut milk, one of the finest things out there. And I do just want to give a little kudos out there to our boat captain, Mana, down in French Polynesia, who expertly, in just minutes, climbed the coconut tree, husked it, grated it, and then went back up the tree for a piece of the burlap that surrounds the leaf sheaths, which he called tapa, and washed it up and handed it to me. And basically it took me just as long to squeeze out the coconut milk as it did for him to do the whole rest of the project, which was really part of my inspiration. I think the more you do it, the easier it gets for you. And, fresh coconut milk really is delicious. The oil content in mature meat is about 50% by weight. And so I know there's actually quite a number of us out there who have oil presses on Kauai, and I'm just blown away at how much oil you can exude out of just, you know, a small amount of coconut. It's a really great yield.
Is there a quality difference for you as one of these people who's pressing her own coconut oil from the coconut oil I might purchase at the health food store? Can you tell the difference when you fresh press it?
Yes. However, I want to admit that my coconut oil, sometimes I thought, didn't taste quite as good. I mean, it was fresher, But you know that sort of almost rancid coconut? I found that the fresh pressed oil that I was making, that was happening really quickly to it. And there is quite a process involved with pressing coconut meat. You have to get it out of the nut and dry it extremely well. The worst enemy of oil is of course water. So you want to dehydrate the coconut very well. And I guess there's the potential that it wasn't dehydrated quite well enough.
Right.
And that some water had potentially contaminated the oil, which may have made it spoil a little faster. I know there's a fellow at the farmer's market that I'm at named Leo who is making fresh coconut oil here for sale. And he chooses to heat it lightly after pressing it. And it actually gives it this deliciously toasty smell and taste. And he says that's what helps it keep better. So it could be that heating it evaporates just the last of that water, which those of us who are into cold-pressed oils, you know, it's kind of a quandary. I will admittedly say we need to do a lot more of experimentation with our oil press here, and I'd like to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And did you experience the process of making coconut oil there for the folks in the Tuamotus?
No, not at all. What is prevalent there is copra production, and copra is basically the crude coconut oil that is used in so many products, more than you would even believe. Body oils, shampoos, conditioners, soaps of all kinds, and the list really just goes on and on and on. Some of the ways that it's named, even in commercial products, wouldn't help you to believe that it really was from coconuts, but it is, and it's definitely one of the main businesses for people who live in tropical Polynesia, across the board from Fiji all the way across. And we were lucky enough to see people unloading some barges, burlap sacks of dried coconut, and there's just this beautiful fragrance that comes along with that copra that is super tantalizing, just like the rest of it. And I just want to say that if you are going to get into using your coconuts a little bit more, it is really good to have a nice machete that you keep really nice and sharp. It is definitely one of the best ways to get into the coconuts. And as always, use lots of caution with your fingers and digits of all kinds when you're doing that. But I know there's some nice machetes available here at some of the garden shops and at the farmers markets. Some people have been offering them as well, and it's a really good tool to have here on our island. Multitude of uses.
Just be safe with it, everybody.
Of course.
Yes. And we want to let people know, we did a few weeks ago have Philip Young as our guest, as well as Trent Coffin there from the Coconut Preservation Mission, and they did set up a Facebook page. Some people were having difficulty finding that page on Facebook, so I just want to let people know that it is listed. If you go to the search field in Facebook and you type in Low Bearing Coconut Preservation Mission, it will take you straight to their Facebook page. So kind of complicated to actually give the web address, but again, if you go to Facebook and you enter Low Bearing Coconut Preservation Mission, you will find their page. Consider liking it and check out the beautiful photographs they have. And yeah, you can be in touch with them if you're interested in cultivating some of these super low bearing trees, so that it's not quite as much work as those tall trees seem to be for those of us who don't know the magic trick of sort of climbing up them like we have wings on, like those Pacific Islanders know how.
Yeah.
It's quite inspiring.
It truly is. It truly is. And that's where I'm headed next, is a couple of nice low-bearing trees, hopefully some of the ones that Trent and Philip have recommended so much.
Nice. Well, we're going to do a featured website segment here that's going to lead us into our plant family. And we have a couple of important websites for those of us who are interested in finding out more information about taro varieties in Hawaii. And I'll start out with the CTAR website. This is the University of Hawaii's College of Tropical Agriculture has a website called Taro Varieties in Hawaii. And this is a companion piece to a historical document at this point, but really a landmark document in terms of taro, in terms of documenting the taro varieties that are unique to the Hawaiian Islands and were found, in addition, the Japanese varieties and other South Sea Island varieties that were found in cultivation in 1939 when Bulletin 84 of the CTAR publication realm was created. And so this website, Taro Varieties in Hawaii, has the various numbered varieties from that 1939 publication. It doesn't go into as much detail, so they really are companion pieces, but it has beautiful photographs of the cut corm, a mature makua plant, or the mother plant, as well as the huli of the oha, or the children that grow around the mother plant. And so it's a really fine resource in that way. And then to complement that, there is a beautiful website that was put together as a collaborative piece with our dear Kumu uncle Jerry Konanui, with great assistance by Craig Elovich, and I'm sure they had other good collaborators involved as well. And this is really a multiple-use website that includes a full school curriculum for including taro education at the school levels. And it also has a really nice collection of the kalo varieties with the same numbers, but also additional varieties. They have information on nutrition and just a beautiful website. And the address there is Kupuna Kalo, KupunaKalo.com. And looking forward to this website expanding with more photographs and more information as time goes on. Our dear Uncle Jerry has been working for with great assistance from his wife Gladys and many other taro researchers for years on updating that Bulletin 84, and I know that they're going to be releasing a really spectacular publication coming up in maybe some years, or maybe sooner than that. We were hopeful that he would join us today, and he wanted to be with us today, but his home is currently threatened by the current lava flow from Kilauea volcano on the Big Island. He's located there in Puna, his family farm. So we send him prayers of safety for him and all of his community members, that their homes be spared the massive force of Pele when she's expressing her function of creating new land and new life and new opportunities here. It's why we're here, is because she does her magic, but we try to dance gently around the edges of where she is currently active. And so it's up to myself and Robin to sort of take the helm here, without Uncle Jerry in body, but he has inspired us for so many years with his teaching, his stories, and so certainly the sharings that we have today are buoyed up by that great guidance that he has given us. And so we're going to jump in right now with All Our Relations, our monthly focus on a plant family, and this month we are focusing on a very special one, and it is Araceae, otherwise known as the Arum family, the Aroid family, and we're going to just dub it right now the Taro family.
Absolutely. Well, I'd like to start by saying the Araceae are monocots, and you've heard us talk about monocots versus dicots many times. So they have a single leaf coming out of the seed, although taro, being vegetatively propagated, it has one leaf coming out of its corm seed, and it's in the Ariflorae order, in the Araceae, Ariflorae Super Order and the Arales Order, and actually that is quite unique grouping, and there's really not a whole lot of relatives nearby. So it is a very unique group of plants, although very diversified within the family, which we're going to talk a lot about as we botanize ourselves into happiness for the next half an hour. And one of the relations in the Araceae family that I'm really fond of is the Alocasias. And I think that maybe you have heard of those or at least seen those. They're known as elephant ears often. And they just have such a beautiful demeanor. They're really, in the ornamental versions, are some of my most favorites of the ornamentals. Mm-hmm. But before I go too deeply into that, I'm sure you want to give some general family information, Paul.
Thanks, Robin. So, yes, 107 genera are currently recognized. And over 3,500 species, 3,700 according to Wikipedia. These are hemiepiphytic, terrestrial, or rock-dwelling monocot herbs. And they actually, I was interested to see that they're completely herbs. There's no woody plants represented at all in this family. And like many family, or sort of the typical thing, is that the relatedness of plants is based on the flower structure. And the aroids, or the taro family relatives, have a very distinctive flower inflorescence that combines a spadix and a spathe. And the spadix is the actual fertile reproductive structure that is quite phallic. And then the spathe is a leaf-like structure that is sort of like a shield behind it and can often be colored, and they can often be fragrant, and they are wonderful. The calla lily is a classic example of one of these flowers that where it's actually grown for the flower itself. Other plants, it's grown as a vegetative plant, but sometimes the flowers are magnificent, and it's sort of an added treat. People plant it for the vegetative character, and then they discover it has this fabulous flower.
Absolutely. You know, I think a great example is a peace lily. I think most of us are familiar with that particular plant, with the white sort of almost looks like a grotto of sorts, and the very male-looking spadix that comes up out of it, but that's a classic example of the Araceae flower.
Indeed. So they're native mostly to the New World tropics, with plenty of exceptions, however. I was surprised to discover that there actually is one native indigenous species in Hawaii, and I had read that there were none, but then when I actually searched on the Smithsonian website, NTBG/Smithsonian website, there is an indigenous species. It's found on Kauai, and it actually turns out to be found in most places in the world where there's not maybe tundra. Or maybe even there are some version of duckweed is a member of this. Spirodella polyrhiza is recognized as the fastest growing plant on Earth. It grows practically everywhere. It is showing biofuel potential, but unfortunately it is also a target of people who think that it could be better if they genetically modify it. So we've got that problem of, you know, one of the plants that on its own is, you know, the best at colonizing the entire planet, and now people are interested in genetically modifying it. Not a particularly good idea, in my opinion. One of the cool things about it is it makes water alkaline that it grows in, and so it has some bioremediation possibilities there. And as well, this plant was very recently, the genome was sequenced. So it's going to be a plant where that genetic sequencing will open all kinds of new research possibilities for understanding its potential use, as well as just understanding plants in general more and their relation to us.
Sure. Is the duckweed, is that what I think of as water lettuce?
It's not the same. Duckweed is a super tiny plant.
Yes,
and
okay.
So, yeah, it becomes a green carpet, yes, essentially.
Okay.
And, yeah, and I suppose it's, I don't know if it's a food for ducks. Duck meat is another name, so I'm assuming it's eaten by waterfowl. At any rate, let's not get hung up on just one plant. 19 naturalized species in Hawaii, 11 on Kauai, and then it really opens up when we look at what people are growing. The cultivated plants in the Hawaiian Islands that belong to this family, 47 cultivated genera, and 650 species or varieties in Hawaii. And a lot of those plants would just start out with one of the more familiar plants for people. And again, a classic example of that spadix and spathe flower would be the anthuriums. And that's one of the ones where there are over 100 species that are grown in the Hawaiian Islands. They're very popular in botanical gardens, but also a very popular plant for people to bring home, but a tricky plant to grow.
Yes, I can vouch for that. It definitely doesn't want any direct sunlight at all. It really wants only indirect light. And given some of our gardens and the way our places are oriented, it's hard sometimes to have shade on something year round. Maybe you get shade for half the year in that spot, but the other half the year is a little bit more sunny.
Right. So great idea to keep it in a pot where you can move it around, and that's where I've seen people have the best luck with them.
Yes, me too.
Moving it around to the shade. But let's go back to your elephant ears.
Sure. Well, anthuriums sure are beautiful, but moving on, the alocasias, some of the most common ones that are found around here, Amazonica, that's sometimes called the African mask. It's the big heart-shaped leaf, kind of pointy, with big, deep white veins and a sort of a shiny surface. And then there's also the velveteen version of that one, which I think might be one of my favorite plants ever. Oh. And that one's known as Friedeck.
They need shade as well?
You know, in the shade, the leaves will get bigger to a certain point, as big as the variety can manage. The more sun they get, the leaf tends to be smaller. So I believe that's just a matter of its photosynthesis capacity. If it's not getting as much light, it wants more leaf to have more chloroplasts to make more food for itself.
Yep.
And then there's also black velvet type one. They're just absolutely lovely, and my experience is they don't get too large, with the exception, of course, of ape. Ape, am I correct? Mm. That's in the alocasia.
It is Alocasia macrorhizus. Yeah. Yes, this is a Polynesian introduced plant, a canoe plant that was brought as a famine food, potentially as a food for pigs, but just a magnificent, gigantic. You really need some room for this plant. It's almost a tree. I mean, if there was one that sort of approached that sort of stature of a small tree, it would be this plant, the ape.
Indeed. And, you know, a website I was checking out yesterday is called alocasiaplants.com. And if you so choose, you can go and Google the hundreds of varieties of available alocasias. They're quite beautiful.
Uh-huh. And many of these plants really not bothered by too many pests or diseases. Wish we could say the same of our beloved kalo, which definitely has all kinds of challenges that we're going to be overcoming through our good growing practices, as well as some good solutions for pest and disease management. But by and large, I think you'll find that if you grow members of this plant family, you're not going to see too many problems. You're not going to have to baby these plants along. They pretty much just go for it. And you were telling me that just to switch to one of our edible friends, the Monstera plant, you were telling me yesterday that you have a particularly healthy individual.
No, I actually, what I have is a story. I was gardening, and there was one of those giant plants going up a tree, and the leaves were falling, and it was kind of a nice place, so I had to go up there with a pole saw and kind of prune off some of the rattier-looking leaves from the bottom. And as I was underneath it and reaching up really high with the pole saw, and I cut it, and this single drop of sap came and glued it right into my eye. And it literally glued my eye closed and burned like crazy, and it was basically the afternoon was over at that point for me as far as gardening went. And I feel lucky that I wasn't blinded by it.
Truly.
Because it is a pretty potent medicine. Although the Monstera, they call it the Mexican breadfruit, because once they really get going and the flowers there get big, the fruits, they're quite delicious, apparently. I've never tried one myself. Have you ever tried one?
Oh, yes. They're quite wonderful. They're sort of pineapple, banana-y-ish. I know it's easy to sort of come up with that combination for any kind of tropical fruit that we're having a hard time describing. But they're really wonderful. As you had mentioned, the Monstera and many other members of this family, the aroid family, have the calcium oxalate crystals in them. Anyone who's ever worked with taro before knows about this. It can cause extreme dermatitis or itchiness of the skin, and that can extend to the inside of your body if you consume an unripe fruit of Monstera. And people who are especially susceptible to those stinging crystals probably should avoid it altogether. For those edible members in the aroid family, the solution to the calcium oxalate is to cook it, and the heating destroys the crystal structure. However, with Monstera fruit, it's a fruit that you want to eat ripe and raw. I suppose you could cook it, but I can't imagine that would be a very good idea. So the few times I've been able to eat Monstera fruit, there's a little bit of prickle back there, but it was so good I was willing to kind of put up with that. So, but do be aware that people have a variation in terms of their ability to deal with. People are more or less sensitive to the calcium oxalate. And it's actually a very good idea if somebody is helping you to prepare some of these plant family foods to not give them the task of cleaning the taro without gloves if you don't know what their sensitivity is. I made that mistake one time, and I gave that task to somebody who turned out to be extremely susceptible. So better to do a little bit of a sort of a sensitivity test on a tiny patch of somebody's skin first off before they, and even to go very cautiously about eating taro. And one of the most important things, I think, when you're cooking taro is to be you sort of like in the times of old, you know, the food taster who would taste the food to make sure that the king and queen wouldn't be poisoned, is sort of that tasting it to make sure that it's not got the itch for people.
The itch. Yes. Well, not to overlook how cool it is that the pothos or philodendron and monsteras are also included in the Araceae family. I know for me that was like a wow moment. Really? It just seemed so interesting that such a viney plant, and Lord knows the philodendron is really successful here on the islands, definitely escapes its house plant stature.
Truly.
In our jungle, wet, humid areas around here.
And like the anthurium, more than 100 species are cultivated here in the Hawaiian Islands, or at least have been over time, over the history that Bishop Museum has kept records. So another plant that can be extremely caustic, the sap of this plant. So for folks who are tackling a big removal job of some brush that may include philodendron, very important to be all covered up. Eye protection, skin protection. You should be covered head to toe before you take out some of these plant family members. So some other friends that we may mention in passing here, because we really want to get to taro, for us, the most important member of that family. But there are some other interesting edible members. And one of the most important ones is Xanthosoma. That's spelled with an X. It's a really fun-looking word, X-rayed up there in the beginning, Xanthosoma. And we have a few family members here, and the one that's really coming to attention here on the North Shore, thanks to our dear friends Sun and Lisa and the good folks at One Song Farm, are making a special effort to raise people's awareness about Tahitian taro, a.k.a. Tahitian spinach. And this is Xanthosoma brasiliense. And funny enough, it's not from Tahiti, and it's not a taro, but a taro relative. And the nice thing about this one is the very fast cooking time of the leaf, meaning very low calcium oxalate quantity. And Robin, you've been enjoying this plant.
I really have. It's so delicious. I was blown away. I didn't quite know what to expect, and as soon as I finished the whole plate of them pretty much by myself, without wanting to share, it was so tasty. It has almost an asparagus kind of flavor to it, particularly the stems, because the texture kind of follows. I immediately knew I want to be growing this plant in my garden. And now I do have a start that Sun was gracious enough to share with me, but I'm curious about its growing, what it likes, because I want to make sure that it can live in the very hot, full sun of my
garden.
Well,
experience is they're real picky. And so when you see plants that are healthy, sometimes in the hands of people you know, here is a master grower. And so the healthy plants growing over there at One Song Farmer, yet another testament to the skills of the farmers there. And I've had difficulty with it. I think it's a very heavy feeder and doesn't like too much sun, but perhaps Sun or Lisa will give us some more tips in one of their next visits to the garden show, or we'll get word from them. But it's one of the harder, I'd say it's one of the harder family members to grow. Much easier, the larger statured Xanthosomas, Xanthosoma sagittifolium and violaceum, both important food plants of Central and South America. We're lucky to have them here. I know there's also a Xanthosoma robustum, which is commonly used as a landscape plant and has been in the Hawaiian Islands for decades, and some likelihood of confusing them, and I am still on the search for a good identification key to tell those two apart, robustum and sagittifolium, just to make sure that we're eating what we should be eating. But I know we do have the sagittifolium here, and tasted it. It's quite good, potato-like. It's the cormels, or the children, that are eaten rather than the central corm. Take a break just a moment to let you know you're listening to In the Garden on the Farm with myself, Paul, and Robin. We've got a quarter hour left to go in the show. We want to encourage you to stay tuned for Kauai Vibrations coming up at 1 o'clock with Tracy, and Shaka Keaka will bring you the Papule show from 3 to 5. So, and a special thanks to Shaka Keaka, who also serves as the engineer for our show. There's a lot, you'd be amazed at how many technical challenges there are to bringing the show to you each and every week, and he's always seems to find the solution just in time. So, Jack, thank you so much for your help. We sure appreciate it, you being on the team with us. And,
absolutely.
Yeah, so... many other, you know, as always, we could go through so many family members here. Maybe we could just mention some of the genus names in very quick passing. The caladiums, very similar to taro in their shape, but just a riot of polka dots and colors for that beautiful landscaping plant. I know that's one Robin's really enjoyed incorporating into the landscape she's created. She's nodding her head and smiling. Diffenbachia, again, the dumb cane plant, something I avoid because it's apparently toxic to dogs. It can kill them, so I'm not going to put it in any of my landscape plantings, but that's a one that's gone naturalized here. Robin mentioned the water lettuce, a much larger statured plant than the duckweed, but a floating aquatic plant that also has a phytoremediation qualities to it, water clarifying qualities to it. Robin, you mentioned the peace lily, and I'm not actually sure I know that one.
The spathiphyllum, I believe it's called, and it's a beautiful, dark, glossy green leaves most of the year, and I think generally in our climate it tends to throw up a bunch of flowers right around Easter, so early spring. Pure white hood, and a pure white spadix, and it's they're quite beautiful. They're common house plants on the mainland for sure.
Got one in your yard?
I don't have one here. No, okay. Actually, they like shade, and that's the one thing I really can't provide for my plantings.
Right, indeed. So what else can we say? We have one in particular I just have to mention is the Titan arum. This is the plant that has the largest single inflorescence of any plant in the plant kingdom, Amorphophallus titanum. I had the opportunity to see this plant flower at Kew Gardens when I was there back in 2009. And it has a horrific stench to it, which attracts flies to pollinate it, thinking that it's a dead animal. But it is quite amazing to see this plant flower, quite outrageous. And wondering if we could actually grow it here. It does have a relative that's actually a food plant, which is the elephant foot Amorphophallus, which is a yam, the elephant foot yam. And seems like it would grow here on Kauai and would be really fun to give that one a shot because it's also going to have a crazy flower to it. All of this being said, we have one particular member of this plant family that is elevated above all the rest, and that, of course, is our beloved taro plant, Colocasia esculenta, certainly one of the most important crop plants in the world and still feeding hundreds of millions of people around the world in the tropical areas. They grow actually a lot of it in Florida, a surprising amount in Florida, but all throughout the tropical world, taro is king in Hawaii. And taro was actually brought by the very first Polynesian settlers, and the cultivation of taro was brought to its highest heights in terms of the technology, the ancient technology that was developed to create the lo'i systems, the flooded field agriculture. The topography of Hawaii and the freshwater resources here presented a novel opportunity for these very astute planters from the Pacific Islands to really develop this high art form of cultivation of taro. And hand in hand with the manipulation of the physical environment was that keen sense of observation of the Hawaiian planters. And taro is a plant that in its native habitat will produce seed because of the native pollinators that are present in Southeast Asia where it has originated from. However, here in the Hawaiian Islands, no pollinator means that seeds are produced only quite rarely. They do produce spontaneously, but it's only in rare situations. And so it's through the genetic mutation of the vegetative cuttings or the vegetative propagules of the taro plant and the keen observation of the Hawaiian grower that has been used to select the many varieties that we know today.
Many, 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 many varieties.
It was thought that there could have been as many as 300 varieties developed in ancient times in Hawaii. Probably some of those were duplicate names, the same variety grown in different localities with different names that may have spoken to the particular importance or association that growers in within a particular region would attribute to that variety. But we know that there are at least 65 to 70 distinct varieties that continue to exist, and only through the great stewardship of just generation after generation, and then really down to a small handful of people over the past 75 years, and great thanks to the University of Hawaii's College of Tropical Agriculture, which has kept the existing collection going strong. And now we have the opportunity to receive these varieties with the efforts of them and many other conservation groups that are making these varieties available. Finding the variety that is right for your location is a bit of a trial and an error. There are varieties that are just plain stronger. And again, the pests and diseases that have come in over the past 20 years have made it a challenge for many of the traditional varieties that are actually a very small genetic base. And so other varieties have come in from other parts of the world that just have more strength, but it is very important that we continue to cultivate the traditional Hawaiian varieties. And definitely would like to mention in this time about the tradition, the traditional connection of the Hawaiian people to taro and the mythology surrounding Haloa, the elder brother of mankind. And I feel like I'm doing all the talking here, but taro was the child, the first child of Papa and Wakea, and these were the deities that begat the human race here in the Hawaiian Islands. And their first child was stillborn. It was buried and sprouted up the first taro plant. When the second child was born, this was the progenitor of all the people in the Hawaiian Islands, and the first born taro cared for and fed the every subsequent generation of people in the Hawaiian Islands. And that interconnection between taro and kane, the humans, has been revered ever since and continues to be revered. And just really one of the most beautiful examples of how connected and humble and grateful that the Hawaiian culture is for the opportunity to flourish on these beautiful islands that we call our home.
Absolutely. You know, a concept I feel a lot with lots of plants is they're our relatives. They're planted at our place, they grow near our homes, and they are our relatives. I think that about avocado trees and bananas and other members of my family who stand strong outdoors 24/7 handling the elements. And I am just a new taro grower, and I'm very inexperienced, but it's very easy for me to feel when you're standing in front of a full-grown taro patch, it's very easy to understand how it is mana. It is the mana. And the concept of the elder brother and the younger brother taking care of one another is really goes deep into my heart as a gardener. I just really enjoy taking care of my plants, and they do indeed take care of me in turn. Mm-hmm. I was cruising the Kupuna Kalo website in the last couple of days, and really impressed by the amount of varieties that are listed on that page. And there's plenty of YouTube videos out there with Uncle Jerry talking story, and he really made me realize there's a variety of taro for every single place, for every kind of climate, for a dry place, for a windy place, for a not windy place, for a wet place. And the Hawaiians were able to cultivate and select out and utilize varieties in the appropriate season. And as we'll hear next week, planting at different seasons will yield you a different kind of plant. You'll get a different growth pattern. And taro is just an amazing, amazing, beautiful plant. I've really come to love it and feel so grateful that we get to spend a whole month talking about it.
Indeed, we will. So next week, please tune in again at the same time. Next week, our special guest will be Chris Kobayashi, a taro farmer who uses organic method process in Hanalei, and will be followed by a couple of other special guests in the subsequent Wednesdays, also focusing on Kalo. So just a quick couple of announcements. The 24th annual Hawaii Tropical Fruit Growers Conference is coming up on Friday through Sunday, September 12th through 14th, so still an opportunity maybe to grab a ticket and head over to Wailuku, Maui for the latest conference. They've got some great speakers and focuses there. You can get more information at hawaiitropicalfruitgrowers.org. And as well, Hawaii Farmers Union meeting coming up next Wednesday, September 10th at the Anahola Clubhouse. More information there at kauaifarmersunion.org. And a variety of agriculture-related classes coming up at KCC, and you can get more information at the Kauai Community College website.
This has been In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts, Robin and Paul, and we'd like to thank you for tuning in today and ask you to please tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life.
Aloha.
A long time that I should have.